Stonehenge is one of the most famous archaeological sites in the world. And now it has a rival not far away, a major prehistoric monument around the Durrington Walls Henge and Woodhenge. And the way this was discovered has caused extra excitement. It's been described as the largest prehistoric structure ever found in Britain and maybe Europe. Professor Vince Gaffney is anniversary chair in landscape archaeology at the University of Bradford. He's part of the Stonehenge Hidden Landscape Project. He leads the UK team creating 3D and virtual imaging of the area. And he says this discovery has completely transformed how the landscape is understood. He joins me now. Hello.
Hi there.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you for having me.
It sounds tremendously exciting. Describe to me what you have found, please.
Absolutely. Well, we've managed to locate, using geophysical survey, a series of immense pits, 10 metres across, 5 metres deep, forming a massive circle over 2 kilometres across around the henge you named as Durrington Walls, which had been previously one of Britain's largest prehistoric sites until we discovered this circle of pits. And it's just about 3 kilometres away from Stonehenge in what most people would have thought was the most studied landscape in Britain and possibly the world.
Yes, that's an extraordinary thing, isn't it? And yet you have found this major construction. Is it all part of the same thing? Stonehenge, Durrington Walls, what you found?
In some ways, I think it is. The Stonehenge obviously attracts most attention. It is preeminent. The stone structure at such an early stage, 4,500 years ago, it is impressive. But it doesn't just stand alone. It actually exists in a very complex landscape, and it has a territory. And the territory for Stonehenge is bounded by rows of burial mounds. And it's always been believed that Stonehenge was something for the ancestors, a place that many people wouldn't have been able to approach for perhaps for reasons of taboo. And only very special people might have been allowed close to the stones itself. Durrington Walls, a very short distance away, an immense site, 500 metres across. You could drop Stonehenge into it half a dozen times and there'd be still be space for more. That has been different. It hasn't got stones. Everything's constructed of wood. There was a village there, actually, underneath the current henge. And people have said that this is where the people who built Stonehenge lived, and that site was for the living. So Stonehenge was for the dead, Durrington Walls for the living. But it didn't have a territory. And we think that's what we found. So you've got two massive prehistoric sites, very binary in respect of the living and the dead, existing side by side with two unique boundaries, one surrounded by the dead, the other surrounded by these massive pits.
So when you say you found the territory, you mean the demarcation of this, what sounds like a kind of residential area?
Oh, it's not residential in this sense. I think it's very, very different. It's more like the temenos of a Roman temple. It's a ritual space, a reserved space, somewhere that people would be guided through for special purposes. The Stonehenge landscape is just one immense ritual landscape, but it fits together in ways that we'd never appreciated before. Hence these two monstrous neighbours with their special territories.
We'll talk in a moment about how you discovered this, but what do you think these shafts or pits were? I mean, one's first thought is that they must have had something in them, like, I don't know, wooden poles, but they're too big for that, right?
They're absolutely too big for it. You could drop some of the big trilithons of Stonehenge into these things. And, I would be a liar if I didn't tell you we don't really know. They are so big. What we've had to do with them so far is to actually take cores through them to retrieve dating material. But there's bone, there's worked stone within them. We know that. But the practical use, if you can apply the word practical in these contexts, is currently unknown. It's just the fact that they define such a massive space. It is 3 square kilometers in area, the area within this circle.
Stonehenge, the mysterious, I mean, there are so many mysteries about Stonehenge, as you know, but it was constructed over, as I understand it, over a period of 14 or 1500 years. That's 70 generations until, I don't know, 1600 BC, something like that. When was it actually begun? What's the earliest sign, the very earliest sign of activity on this Stonehenge landscape that we know of so far?
Well, interestingly, it's a lot earlier than that.
Is it?
The site itself actually really develops between about 3000 and 4000 BC. It starts off as an enclosure with a series of smaller pits with cremation burials in. But just a small short distance away from the site, in the old car park for the visitor centre, were a series of very unique massive posts which were excavated 4,000 years earlier. And these posts are effectively the first structure in Britain. They are Mesolithic, the Middle Stone Age, hunter-gatherers. Stonehenge is a farmer, an early farmer development, but it's clear that this landscape developed some sort of sanctity very, very early on, and people just kept coming back and back and back to it, and the whole area became more and more ornate. It is remarkable, but I suspect a lot of large ritual complexes around the world start in small ways and just develop like this.
About 5 years ago, I think, you said that you had found evidence of what you thought to have been a ritual area of about 90 standing stones buried at Durrington Walls,
Yes.
sounded like a temple of some kind. That's clearly part of this complex.
It's part of the story, but it's both more complex and less complex at the same time. We found those. They're massive features, 2 by 1.5 meter, meters in width. There's probably hundreds of these things that were underneath the banks of this massive structure. In fact, but they don't have stones on in. They're rammed with stone, and they did have probably huge posts, perhaps up to 6 meters high, which ring this, but they were only up for a very short time. And then they were literally ritually killed. They were pulled out, and the massive post settings rammed with stone, which is what we'd seen. That, if you like, was a was an a period of massive development of the henge itself, but this is much larger. And that's what we keep seeing within the Stonehenge landscape. We keep finding new stuff because of how we're archaeologists are operating now.
Those stones, are they the same kind of stones as the Saracen stones at Stonehenge?
No, this is just chalk which has been rammed into these particular features. It's
Okay.
you do get this in prehistory where objects are ritually killed, if you like, in some ways, and this is what seems to have happened here. It's a very ornate sequence at Durrington Walls, and we keep adding to it.
So let's talk about how you discovered all these things. You're using magnetometers and radar. How are you doing it?
Yes. Well, the thing you've got to understand about archaeology, everyone believes nothing that archaeologists do nothing other than dig.
Yes.
Don't get me wrong, I love digging, but the problem with digging is you can only ever dig small areas. Archaeologists tend to go to the things that we can see, the humps, the bumps, the burial mounds, the henges. And the result of that is that we tend to know an awful lot about a very small area. The fact is that even after several centuries of archaeological and antiquarian work, most of the landscape is unknown. It's terra incognita. And the problem with that is the absence of evidence has become the evidence of absence. The presumption is there's nothing there. Well, that was fine until pretty much we started working at Stonehenge. And we started to apply geophysics at a grand scale. In the previously, when we'd used geophysics, it was one rather friendless archaeologist walking across a field with an instrument that went ping every meter. Well, the kit we're looking at is multiple sensors tied into GPSs and driven across the landscape on behind quad bikes or tractors at 20 or 30 kilometers an hour, picking up data almost seamlessly. So we've been producing maps all the way across the landscape, in between the monuments, in the areas we didn't know anything about. And the consequence of that is, surprise, surprise, it's full of stuff. And some of the stuff we've never seen before. And the ultimate evidence for that are these pits, because they are so large, and yet we haven't had sight of them.
Well, haven't people seen some kind of submerged pits and thought that they were sinkholes or ponds?
Well, this is a separate development.
Is it?
Yes, you're right. What happened was we'd originally seen some of these things, and they were more than a kilometer away from the henge itself. There was no reason to link them together. We noted them, and we thought that they might be dew ponds. These are but shallow boat basins, which are created manually in the chalk because it has no surface water. You puddle it with clay, rain collects in, and sheep primarily can use them to get water. We thought they might be something like that, or alternately, some weird stuff the military had done in the past, because the military has been expanding and contracting over this area for hundreds of years. And they do straight all military. The military like to dig things, and we thought, well, it could be something like that. However, we noticed that far to the north of them, of Durrington, they'd also spotted a couple of strange features in their surveys, the magnetometer surveys. They'd stripped them, and they just said, well, these are natural features, solution hollows in the chalk. Chalk dissolves in certain points where there may be flaws in the rock, and that's what they thought. They didn't dig it out. They just mapped them. They said there was archaeological material associated, but that was it. We saw this. We then started looking at the vast amounts of data which had been produced since we did the first surveys, and realised immediately we could see nine of them stretching from the River Avon in a massive arc. And that arc coincided with a northern arc, which contractors had seen, and some other features we added to theirs. So we ended up with 20 of these things in two massive arcs around the Henge Monument. And nature doesn't produce things like that. They have to be either dug and man-made, or alternatively, some of them may be natural features, but they've been appropriated and added to over time. That isn't impossible. But at the moment, we can't be certain. But they all look exactly the same. They're all about the same size. On this massive circle.
You'll be telling me next that you don't believe in corn circles.
They don't look as good as my circle. Let me tell you.
Listen, what you've been doing, this discovery, is this a precursor to excavation, or is it instead of excavation?
In most cases, geophysics provides an alternative to excavation. It gives you the opportunity to manage the landscape, because you can't manage what you don't know about. And if we do know about things, then we can deal with them. There are cases, I suggest, that sometimes we know so little about very important features that we might have to do an excavation. And who knows, in the future, with the permission of the National Curators, Historic England, English Heritage, the National Trust, perhaps we may be able to look into these things. Whatever they are a critical part of this landscape, and we do need to know more about them.
And the question is whether large Neolithic shafts are worth discovering unless you can share them visually with the public.
Yes, there is that argument, but I'm going to say something else because I do think it's important. You know, excavation is the last thing you do. Excavation is destruction. Once you've dug something, it's gone, and you have to do that you have to think very carefully before you do that. It's a resource which is limited. It's finite. We can't replace it once it's gone. I think we're at least we're at least behoven to see what we can do with the data that we have. And there is other information coming out about these remarkable pits that tells us about the past. And I think that's important. And the most significant is the relationship between these pits, Durrington, and another site called the Larkhill Causeway Enclosure. Because the pits seem to be oriented and on the same distance from the Henge to this earlier site. It was dug at least 1,000 years before the Henge monument itself. And this looks like a massive cosmological statement that they're tying this new massive boundary, this ritual boundary, with a much earlier site, which they clearly deem as important. Now, that's one thing. But I think there's something else that goes beyond that without digging. The capacity to lay out a string of massive pits nigh on a kilometre away from the Henge monument over valleys and low hills is actually quite interesting because it's such a distance. And the implication of laying out a circle at that distance seems to be that these people have the capacity to count and tally. You wouldn't be able to memorize a distance of 850-odd meters away. You have to be able to pace it out and count it out. And the fact that we are beginning, that this appears to provide pretty good evidence for counting at such a very early period is a massive insight into the societies. And I think I'd go a bit further. We tend to regard counting as a rather abstract thing. We count our money. We count the time that we waste, I guess, day to day. But the ability to count in these contexts was probably not as we understand it. It's a social construct. The reason counting was in fact to help them to measure out their cosmology into the landscape and then to dig these huge pits at a specific distance in order to record that cosmology or belief system. And so we're actually getting quite significant information simply by looking at this, mapping it and analysing it. And we'll do that before we dig a hole in the ground, especially holes as big as these things are.
How do you make the link between what you're seeing there and cosmology?
Well, to a certain extent, you have to believe that there are some sites which do not fit prosaic economic positions. Now, it is to a certain extent, I think it's true that there's no such thing as a ritual site. There's only sites in which rituals occur. But nonetheless, the investment in sites like the Henges in both at Durrington and Stonehenge involve mobilization of large communities for esoteric and probably arcane purposes, much of which we don't entirely understand. You have to equate something like Stonehenge with cathedrals, you know, the big medieval cathedrals. Many of them start as small churches, some of them as martyria, You know, St. Albans, a good example for the, the shrine of the Roman martyr on the site, which are then visited and made ornate in increasingly in ways that we sometimes find puzzling. But perhaps in 4,000 years' time, people will wonder why we created cathedrals in the same way.
There are a number of roads around the place in Stonehenge. You've got famously the A303 and the A344 there. And there have been plans afoot for quite a while to build a road tunnel near there. Will yes. your findings stop that?
Well, I don't think my works should stop anything as such. However, this is a World Heritage Site. It is, I think, Britain's premier archaeological site. It's a site which, along with the pyramids, everyone knows. You know, I suspect most of your listeners, if they had a silhouette of Stonehenge put in front of them, they'd know exactly what it was and where it is. You have to be very carefully about what you do in this landscape. The truth is, this class of archaeological monument that we've essentially brought to the fore is new, and it is also true that within the landscape around Stonehenge there are a number of very big pits, and we don't know what their function is, and we have to make sure that these are investigated fully. We can't go ahead simply on the expectation that we know and understand what we see in the Stonehenge landscape on the basis of what we have understood 10 years ago. It doesn't appear to be rational. And future generations are not going to forgive us for that. Now, I know a number of my colleagues certainly object to the tunnel, the short tunnel at any rate, within the World Heritage Site. And personally, I would assert that a longer tunnel stretching beyond the edges of the essential Stonehenge landscape, as it can be defined, should be considered. The cost of that, we understand, is significant. But nonetheless, it is our premier archaeological site. If it is not worth spending on, you have to consider whether it is worth it.
Crikey, though, if you start driving your machines around the entire length of Britain, you're likely to find all sorts of things nobody knew about, and all roads would come to an end.
I think that would be a very strange thing if it did. There aren't that many Stonehenges really in Britain. There are things which are variably important, but Stonehenge in its landscape is unique at a level of whatever you want to gauge it by. It's not, I think, the same argument.
Very good to talk to you. Thank you. Professor Vince Gaffney, who is an archaeologist, he's a professor of archaeology, chair in landscape archaeology at the University of Bradford.